From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
This week has seen the National Summit on Women's Safety, which has focused, among other issues, on what needs to be done to combat the appalling rate of domestic violence in Australia. The summit is just one of a number of fronts on which issues affecting women have come to the fore this year. Brittany Higgins' allegation that she was raped in a minister's office by a colleague has shone a light on the culture of Parliament House as a workplace. Women's marches around the nation were sparked by the Higgins allegation and an allegation of historical rape against Christian Porter, which he denies. As it scrambled for a political response, the government resurrected the Respect at Work report that it had received in 2019, done by Sex Discrimination Commissioner Kate Jenkins. Scott Morrison said that report was a game changer, but the government last week was selective in what it legislated and what it left alone from the groundbreaking report. Kate Jenkins joins us today to discuss progress and lack of progress on a range of issues of vital importance to Australian women. Kate Jenkins, can we start with your take on the summit on women's safety? What did it achieve, and what do you say to those who see it as primarily a talk fest?
The summit came at a really timely moment. I think the conversation in this country has really been building for a number of years, but particularly in the last 12 months, to talk about violence against women more broadly. The summit, I would put the summit, for those people who question what its purpose was, in the bigger context, which is Australia in 2010 established the first 12-year national plan on reducing violence against women and their children. And that plan has hit a whole lot of, really caused a whole lot of change, actually. It was a bipartisan, so state, territories and federal. It established things like Our Watch, ANROS, the Safety Research Organisation, 1800 Respect, a whole lot of things like that. And we really, as a country, have changed our perspective on prevention of violence. We've really increased our focus, and we've also learnt that domestic and family violence is a problem, but also there are other kinds of violence, like sexual harassment, like online violence. So in the context of that plan, that last 12-year plan finishing next year, the summit was actually part of the government's consultation over what should be in this next 10 or 12-year plan. So while some people will look and say, it was done for a PR exercise, in fact, it was part of what's almost been a 12-month consultation process. And for those who are really passionate and interested, there's still time to put in a written submission, I think, till about the 15th of September to DSS with your views on what should be in this plan. And the expectation, I think, of the whole community, certainly of me, is that this next plan is much more ambitious, that we see real change, we start addressing violence against women and children across the board. And so I guess from my role, which is obviously very well informed on this context, the summit was one input, but it did, because they allowed at least public engagement to watch it, it got more people to think about the issues of violence. And of course, as you would know, some really impressive speakers, and a standout for me was Grace Tame, who really brings that survivor perspective and is really incredibly powerful in reminding us why we're doing this work.
I guess when you put it in the history context like that, Kate, people would ask really why we have such a horrendous problem of domestic violence in this country. We've obviously done quite a lot of work on it over the years. We're an advanced country, basically economically prosperous country, although there are many areas of disadvantage. But why is it so bad? How does it compare with other comparable countries?
I think we In comparison to other countries, we do better on some things and worse on others. But at its fundamental heart, there is really no country that has achieved true gender equality. And in Australia, many of the things about violence intersect with the issues about why we have a lack of women in leadership, why women's economic security is struggling, why we still need to get more women into politics. And so as a country, I think the violence is the tragic end of something that actually is a community-wide issue, that women and men have been sort of pigeonholed in stereotype roles about what they do at home and at work. And so I do think this really escalating and really passionate demand for change is perfectly well placed and reasonable. And I would say what I would say has happened over the last 10 years has been a shift from this assumption that, well, women, you know, should be at home looking after the children and men should be the ones who are the primary breadwinners, to a realization that all of those things can lead to violence. They certainly do create barriers for men and women depending on what they want to do with their lives. So I do believe that the call for the next plan is to say, okay, everyone got started. We've certainly, as a community, we now understand, you know, not everyone agrees with it, but understand that, you know, assuming girls can't kick and boys shouldn't be home looking after their, you know, men shouldn't look after their children, all of those things contribute to the disrespect. But the next plan, I think the demand is that, notwithstanding that evolving knowledge, have we got the systems? Are we putting the investment into this issue? And are we making the changes that will have an impact? Because it's not just the amount of money, it's also what we're doing. But I think more broadly, who's involved? So I think the new plan will do things like look more broadly at violence. It will engage the business community in a way that wasn't engaged at all. And there will be some other changes that really move us towards prevention as well as better responses.
Obviously, many, many ideas and options were canvassed at the summit. But in terms of immediate big things that should be done, are there two or three issues you'd highlight? For example, do we need changes in the justice system urgently?
It's really hard to pick two or three because, as you can imagine, Michelle, if it was that simple, I would hope that we would have done it. But if I pull out a couple of threads that came out very strongly, one was about the justice system, the policing responses, and particularly, for example, simple things like national consistencies of laws about consent was something that Grace Tame specifically focused about. But there was a lot of conversations about us remembering to keep victims at the centre and then to recognise that different people experiencing violence have different experiences. So the language of intersectionality comes up, which means that, you know, an Aboriginal woman with a disability will be having a much greater risk and disadvantage than other women or people in the community. So that would be one side of the equation, and particularly justice and crisis response. There was a discussion related to that about housing, just the availability of housing across the board. My colleague Kay Patterson talked about that issue of the increase in a number of older women who are homeless and how important housing is for both women's, you know, lifetime economic security, but also their ability to live or escape violence, live with. And so she really focused on things like elder abuse as well. I think, again, another of my colleagues, the National Children's Commissioner, really highlighted that women themselves are victims of violence. I think we often talk about children and domestic violence as if they're the witnesses, but she's really passionate that be more at the centre. And I guess a couple of other things. So I'm not doing a short enough laundry list for you, Michelle, but
it's all right.
A couple of the other discussion points was really more of an engagement of men and both as just people who can contribute to the change, but also as perpetrators. I know someone talked about, we always talk about violence against violence against women or women's safety, but we should be talking about violence by men. The conversation really was had, you know, that if we want to do true prevention, then we need to be engaging men. And I guess the other, you know, fabulous presentation was from Julian McGrant on tech. It's mind-blowing to think of the violence and the harm that can be done by use of tech, tech-facilitated abuse on women. So that certainly would not have even crossed their minds in 2010, I think, and we're really leading in that work.
I noticed that one or two of the Indigenous women have called for a specific Indigenous women's plan. Do you think that that would be the way to go?
Yes, I do support that. I know there has been a specific task force or group that has supported the development of the plan that is specifically Indigenous women. But the reason I support that is because my colleague June Oscar, who's the National Torres Strait Island and Social Justice Commissioner, so she was one of those women who has done a lot of work across the country on her project, We Only You Thuggany, talking to women, Aboriginal women. She has come up with a view, and I completely understand why, that the experiences in Aboriginal communities have so many complexities that the communities need to be involved in those solutions, and that this is a group that just, you know, combining them in with everyone else just simply doesn't address their issues, but also it doesn't help with the solutions that can be designed by the communities. So those voices were very loud. I noted the Minister Rustin at the end said she had heard that call. So I would expect there will be further thinking about what that individual plan would look like, which is not to say that issues for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Island women and their children will not be in this plan. They will most certainly, I think, be in the next plan, but this would be an additional tailored plan is what I would expect.
Moving to another front, you're still completing a report that you're doing for the government on the culture in the parliamentary workplace. Now, I know you can't say too much about this because it's still evolving, but where's it up to and what can you tell us about your progress?
Yes, that review commenced in March of this year, and it is a very broad-based review. It is looking at issues of sexual harassment, sexual assault and bullying, but also the broader culture in people that work in Commonwealth parliamentary workplaces, which...
And just to put this in context for our listeners, this was obviously out of the Brittany Higgins allegation.
Absolutely. It was for the calls and paying great tribute to Brittany in her both courage and really leadership in speaking up that has brought around the bipartisan support for this review to be conducted. And I think as someone who is involved in and around workplaces, having everyone who's, you know, holds leadership positions in that place supporting the review has been really critical for it. So we're due to report in November, and as you would know, I am very I'm not speaking in the middle of the review about the actual content of it, but in July we have provided a midterm update, which really was a progress update to just confirm that we've had really quite strong engagement. So the people that can talk to us in our data collection involves both current and former parliamentarians, staff, even volunteers, people who work in electoral offices, and people who work in the parliament. So you, Michelle, as an occupant, are covered by this review, as well as, you know, the cafe owners and the security people and the cleaners. So it's a very broad review. We have conducted, I'll say, hundreds of interviews and received hundreds of submissions. So at July, we'd have 345 participants, but there's been a rush to some degree, sharing our progress update reminded everyone that they needed to get involved because we were closing fast. So we've done interviews, received submissions, we've done a survey, we've held focus groups, we've got information about policies and procedures from across the Parliament, and we're also conducting research. So it will be comprehensive. It's been incredibly, it's been a privilege to do the work, but we're also really interested in our research looking internationally on this kind of review that's happened in a number of other countries, most recently New Zealand and also the UK. So it's going well, and we are working as hard as we can so that we can meet that deadline in November to deliver the report to government.
Now, your respected work report, of course, looked at workplaces generally, and the Prime Minister was very effusive in his praise of that report, even though the government didn't get round to dealing with it for quite a long time. And as it's turned out, the government has cherry-picked when it comes to some of its central recommendations. What hasn't it done that it should have done?
Michelle, thanks for asking, because I think the last week has been a very busy week in looking at things like violence against women and sexual harassment. So last week, the government passed the legislation which amended the Sex Discrimination Act and the Fair Work Act. My report made 55 recommendations, and of those, the legislative reform recommendations for the Sex Discrimination and the Fair Work Act were 12 of those recommendations. And your question reflects the narrative that actually caused a really active debate in Parliament about why and whether the other six recommendations, so six were legislated, the other six should be included in the bill right now. From my point of view, both I would like it to have been fully covered right now, but the government's response when they gave their full response to the all 55 recommendations in April did indicate they would do some legislative reform now and they would take longer to consider the other six. So they haven't said no to me right now, and I am going to hold them to their commitment that they will continue to consider those reforms. But I guess people are asking, well, what didn't they put in that is most notable? And the one that I have a view that needs to be made is the reform to the Sex Discrimination Act. So that is the only legislation that at the moment outright prohibits sexual harassment. And the only way someone could, bring that act to life is if a complaint is made. So the recommendation that I made was that there should be a positive duty on employers, included in that legislation, to take the burden off victims and to sort of shift the employer focus more towards what they're doing to prevent sexual harassment rather than what they'll do to show that they shouldn't be held to be at fault when someone brings a complaint forward. Now, the discussion about that, just to explain, is that we also found that the safe work legislation does also require employers to take action to prevent sexual harassment. They haven't been doing it in that way, but the regulators have become much more interested. And so the government's response has been, we think the safety legislation should do the work. I would be delighted if that was the case, but we thought long and hard, and I made both recommendations just to encourage that they align. So that's the legislative comments, but I guess it's worth updating you, Michelle, on what's happened. So of the 55 recommendations, I know there's lots of discussion about what was accepted and what wasn't, but by and large, they were accepted in some way or another. So there is a lot of activity, including in the corporate world, in workplaces, as well as within government. So I chair the Workplace Sexual or the Respect at Work Council, which brings together all the key regulators in safety, Fair Work Commission, Fair Work Ombudsman, and the Human Rights Commission's workers' comp bodies. And we are looking at improving our processes, and we have as associates unions and employers to assist us. And there are a number of other initiatives that are in place, training, the next survey is in train. We're looking at media and education programs. Safe Work Australia has produced new resources. So overall, even though I will, continue and persist with ensuring that all the recommendations are put into place, there has been a lot of action, I would say, since April of this year. So again, very grateful for Brittany Higgins' advocacy, because I think it's not just changed the parliamentary views, it's changed the corporate and the business world's view of the action that they need to take. So that's sort of the really quick update on what's happening at the moment on respect at work.
How does Australia compare on these sorts of issues with other countries?
In sexual harassment, we know that this piece of work started because of the global Me Too conversation. When we did the national inquiry on sexual harassment in particular, we identified that actually this is was a problem in many, particularly many other Western countries, where also there are still challenges in achieving gender equality. So there is the World Economic Forum rankings that are considered, and Australia, I think right now, ranks at 50th. So as a country, that's not really acceptable in a global stage. But in terms of the issues we're facing, gender inequality is a global problem, and it's really important that we take the leadership, because we want to be better in the world. But actually, when you read these heartbreaking stories on, almost on a daily basis in our newspaper of the violence, of the injustice, and of the lack of women in leadership roles, it reminds us why we both want to be globally leading, but actually if we want our community to be the community we expect for ourselves and our children, we need to take some steps to improve our position on gender equality.
Well, 50th sounds as though we've got a heck of a long way to go, I must say.
We started in 2006 at, I think it was 15. So yes, we definitely, I think other countries have been really moving at a faster pace than we have. We are world leading in terms of number one of educating women and girls. So the problem does tend to arise once those women leave university, get streamed into lower paid jobs, get expected to stay at home, don't have access to good, flexible, affordable childcare. There's a whole range of things that then build up in the Australian community, and I think it's time we change that. And I also think COVID's both highlighted them, but then hopefully created the disruptive moment where we really start thinking of changing that.
Well, talking about education, we tend in this whole debate to concentrate properly enough, but to concentrate on victims and survivors of harassment and worse. But do we also need to find better ways to empower young women? For example, at many universities, we've had fairly horrific reports of the level of sexual harassment. How do you actually give young women more agency or help them get more agency in their own lives?
Yes, and it's pretty heartbreaking to think how young women are, and they absolutely are, entering universities and workplaces workplaces still facing discrimination, harassment, and violence. Your question asked about education, and I think what connected to that, I'll probably answer to how you empower young women, not entirely, but partly, that we need to educate all of our community, and particularly men, and particularly expect that people who hold positions of power take a more active role to ensure that everyone who's in their workplace or at the university are safe. So that's sort of the looking both at prevention, but also recognizing that part of the challenge we have in Australia, and our National Community Attitude Survey, which is again another world-leading piece of work, tells us that a lot of people still don't believe victims when they come forward. They believe gender equality has been achieved. They believe that, you know, women really are complaining too much. So there are some really deeply embedded attitudes. So those young women are entering places, and I know a lot of those young women, they're truly shocked when they discover they enter workplaces and they're sort of expected to make the coffees rather than to do, you know, the work that their male peers are doing. So that's the broader education point of view. But for those young women, I do think we're at a real turning point moment, and I think that we need to keep with this community conversation. So we've had so many really, and I hate that we have to say courageous, but it is very risky for women to speak up, even in their workplaces and certainly in a public environment this year, but we've had many over the years, but this year we've particularly had Grace Tame, Brittany Higgins, and I would add to that Chanel Contos, as well as others, as she raised the issue of consent at schools and rapes of schoolgirls. So I think to some degree our young women and our young men come through and believe equality is, you know, is expected. But in terms of when small things happen, I think that if all of us will change, but when those young women see these other women speak up, there's a risk that they will look at that and think, wow, that looks really hard. But I hope, and I know those women who have spoken up, every single one who speaks up that I've spoken to says, I'm speaking up because I don't want this to happen to someone else. And I think young women, if it's normalized that you will speak up about your experiences, then that will create safer environments. It will help women speak up, but hopefully it will also create a whole lot of allies and men who will also support them and speak up as well.
Can we end on a couple of general questions? One is whether there are big generational differences among women these days in how they see their situation and what sort of problems they feel they face.
I do think there is a generational difference in how you, where you see the barriers, particularly for young women who've come through school and had often performed very well and had equal opportunities and come through university with the same experience. And whilst they might see the world around, I think they have a conviction that that's not going to be their world. And I will say I was the same. I'm now 53. And when I came through, I think I was in that category. We know that this was the problem for my mother, but this won't be the problem for me. So I do think there's a different understanding of how gender inequality works and plays out. And as a young woman, you also haven't come up to the challenges that you face when you choose to have a child and how all those things play out. So that might be their perception. I think their expectations are rightly high. We're a country that prides itself on saying everyone gets a fair go. This goes to the very heart of that. But I think that they are coming through with that, the expectation for better. But I think at the same time, the one thing, and this is a great question to be talking about, the one thing that I've been really mindful of in my current and previous role as a Victorian Human Rights Commissioner is very much this idea that the issue of violence is about some old dinosaurs, some men from the old days who don't understand how we operate now. The research that we have, the ABS Personal Safety Survey and also the National Community Attitude Survey that ANROS does, all of those things show that young women are experiencing violence and young men have some very concerning attitudes. So as a community, I think that the facts don't match this idea that the dinosaurs will die out and we'll all be good, that we're socializing young people to perhaps still have concerning attitudes. And one of the interesting topics to circle back at the summit was a presentation on the evolution of the Stop It at the Start campaign, which is those small snippets that we see everywhere about, you know, don't throw like a girl and he only pushes you because he likes you, sort of those small messages. They talked about how when that was introduced 5 years ago, people thought that was crazy to suggest that these were connected with violence. We have now understood that they are connected. And so I do think that as the most important thing at this moment in time is to not assume this gender inequality or inequality broadly is going to die out with the older generation, that it is something that's part of our society. So I guess that's sort of covering a bit of territory, but really that we're all behind those young women to be able to demand their rights and then let them get on with whatever job they want to do and not have to spend their whole time worrying about, I hope, not worrying about gender the whole time, that just know that they're valued for who they are.
And just finally, Kate Jenkins, do you think that matters affecting women specifically will be an issue or series of issues at the coming election? For example, in the way they were in the early 1970s when you had the women's electoral lobby being quite influential and very activist.
I do think that the next election, half of our population are women, and I think that there will be active conversations about what are the things that women expect from our elected politicians and how many women are being offered to us as candidates for the election. Absolutely. And I think that is only right, as I said, as I think more than 50% of the population, that is right. And the conversations that we've had, I think from 2017, even when the Me Too movement really started, have been building over time since then. And I think that I can't see those conversations will be slowing down, and I don't think they should either. I think it's a really, it's to our credit that these conversations are being had.
Kate Jenkins, thank you very much for talking with the Conversations Politics podcast today. Thank you to my producer, Tom Glassie. We'll be back with another interview very soon. Goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevere. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.